I stand on the icy overpass for a while, drinking, and then I walk down to the skating rink. A few couples and little kids are skating. The kids chase each other and skate backward and do figure eights. I rent a pair of more or less my size skates, lace them on, and walk onto the ice. I skate the perimeter of the rink smoothly and without thinking too much. Repetition. Movement. Balance. Cold air. It's nice. The sun is setting. I skate for an hour or so, then return the skates, pull on my boots, and walk. I walk west on Randolph, and south on Michigan Avenue past the Art Institute. The lions are decked out in Christmas wreaths. I walk down Columbus Drive. Grant Park is empty except for the crows, which strut in circle over the evening blue snow. The streetlights tint the sky orange above me. It's a deep cerulean blue over the lake. At Buckingham Fountain, I stand until the cold becomes unbearable, watching seagulls wheeling and diving, fighting over a loaf of bread somebody has left for them. A mounted policeman rides slowly around the fountain once, and then sedately continues south. I walk. My boots are not quite waterproof, and despite my several sweaters, my overcoat is a bit thin for the dropping temperature. Not enough body fat. I'm always cold from November to April. I walk along Harrison, over to State Street. I pass the Pacific Garden Mission, where the homeless have gathered for shelter and dinner. I wonder what they're having. I wonder if there's any festivity there in the shelter. There are a few cars. I don't have a watch, but I guess that it's about 7. I've noticed lately that my sense of time passing is different. It seems to run slower than other people's. An afternoon can be like a day to me. An L ride can be an epic journey. Today is interminable. I've managed to get through most of the day without thinking too much about Mom, about the accident, about all of it. But now in the evening, walking, it's catching up with me. I realize I'm hungry. The alcohol is worn off. I'm almost at Adams, and I mentally review the amount of cash I have on me and decide to splurge on dinner at the Berghoff, a venerable German restaurant famous for its brewery. The Berghoff is warm and noisy. There are quite a few people eating and standing around. The legendary Berghoff waiters are bustling importantly from kitchen to table. I stand in line, thawing out, amidst chattering families and couples. Eventually, I'm led to a small table in the main dining room toward the back. I order a dark beer and a plate of duckwurst with spätzle. When the food comes, I eat slowly. I polish off all the bread, too, and realize that I can't remember eating lunch. This is good. I'm taking care of myself. I'm not being an idiot. I'm remembering to eat dinner. I lean back in my chair and survey the room. Under the high ceilings, dark paneling, and murals of boats, middle-aged couples eat their dinners. They've spent the afternoon shopping, or at the symphony. And they talk pleasantly of the presents they have bought, their grandchildren, plane tickets, and arrival times. Mozart. I have an urge to go to the symphony now, but there's no evening program. Dad is probably on his way home from Orchestra Hall. I would sit in the upper reaches of the uppermost balcony, the best place to sit acoustically, and listen to Das Lied von der Erde, or Beethoven, or something similarly un-Christmassy. Oh well, maybe next year. I have a sudden glimpse of all the Christmases of my life lined up one after another, waiting to be gotten through, and despair floods me. No. I wish for a moment that time would lift me out of this day and into some more benign one. But then I feel guilty for wanting to avoid the sadness. Dead people need us to remember them, even if it eats us, even if all we can do is say, I'm sorry, until it is as meaningless as air. I don't want to burden this warm, festive restaurant with grief that I would have to recall the next time I'm here with Graham and Gramps, so I pay and leave. Back on the street, I stand, pondering. I don't want to go home. I want to be with people. I want to be distracted. I suddenly think of the Get Me High Lounge, a place where anything can happen, a haven for eccentricity. Perfect. I walk over to Water Tower Place and catch the number 66 Chicago Avenue bus, get off at Damon, and take the number 50 bus north. The bus smells of vomit, and I'm the only passenger. The driver is singing Silent Night in a smooth church tenor, and I wish him a Merry Christmas as I step off the bus at Wabanzia. As I walk past the fix-it shop, snow begins to fall, and I catch the big wet flakes on the tips of my fingers. I can hear music leaking out of the bar. The abandoned ghost train track looms over the street in the sodium vapor glare, and as I open the door, someone starts to blow a trumpet and hot jazz smacks me in the chest. I walk into it like a drowning man, which is what I have come here to be. There are about 10 people in the place, counting Mia, the bartender. 3 musicians, trumpet, standing bass, and clarinet, occupy the tiny stage, and the customers are all sitting at the bar. The musicians are playing furiously, swinging at maximum volume like sonic dervishes. And as I sit and listen, I make out the melody line of White Christmas. Mia comes over and stares at me, and I shout, "Whiskey and water," at the top of my voice, and she bawls, "House?" And I yell, "Okay," and she turns to mix it. There's an abrupt halt to the music. The phone rings, and Mia snatches it up and says, "Get me high." She sets my drink in front of me, and I lay a 20 on the bar. "No," she says into the phone. "Well, dang. Well, fuck you, too." She whomps the receiver back into its cradle like she's dunking a basketball. Mia stands looking pissed off for a few moments, then lights a Pall Mall and blows a huge cloud of smoke at me. "Oh, sorry." The musicians troop over to the bar and she serves them beers. The restroom door is on the stage, so I take advantage of the break between sets to take a leak. When I get back to the bar, Mia has set another drink in front of my bar stool. "You're psychic," I say.
"You're easy."
She plunks her ashtray down and leans against the inside of the bar, pondering.
"What are you doing later?"
I review my options. I've been known to go home with Mia a time or two, and she's good fun and all that. But I'm really not in the mood for casual frivolity at the moment. On the other hand, a warm body is not a bad thing when you're down. I'm planning to get extremely drunk. What did you have in mind?
"Well, if you're not too drunk, you could come over. And if you're not dead when you wake up, you could do me a huge favor and come to Christmas dinner at my parents' place in Glencoe and answer to the name Rafe."
"Oh, God, Mia, I'm suicidal just thinking about it. Sorry." She leans over the bar and speaks emphatically.
"Come on, Henry, help me out. You're a presentable young person of the male gender. Hell, you're a librarian. You won't freak when my parents start asking who your parents are and what college you went to."
"Actually, I will. I will run straight to the powder room and slit my throat. Anyway, what's the point? Even if they love me, it just means they'll torture you for years with, whatever happened to that nice young librarian you were dating? And what happens when they meet the real Rafe?"
"I don't think I'll have to worry about that."
"Come on.
I'll perform triple X sex acts on you that you've never even heard of."
I have been refusing to meet Ingrid's parents for months. I have refused to go to Christmas dinner at their house tomorrow. There's no way I'm going to do this for Mia, whom I hardly know. "Mia, any other night of the year. Look, my goal tonight is to achieve a level of inebriation at which I can barely stand up, much less get it up. Just call your parents and tell them Rafe is having a tonsillectomy or something." She goes to the other end of the bar to take care of 3 suspiciously young male college types. Then she messes around with bottles for a while, making something elaborate. She sets the tall glass in front of me.
"Here, it's on the house."
The drink is the color of strawberry Kool-Aid. "What is it?" I take a sip. It tastes like 7-Up. Mia smiles an evil little smile.
"It's something I invented. You want to get smashed? This is the express train."
"Oh, well, thank you." I toast her and drink up. A sensation of heat and total well-being floods me. "Heavens, Mia, you ought to patent this. You could have little lemonade stands all over Chicago and sell it in Dixie cups. You'd be a millionaire."
"Another?"
"Sure." As a promising junior partner in DeTamble and DeTamble, Alcoholics at Large, I've not yet found the outer limit in my ability to consume liquor. A few drinks later, Mia is peering at me across the bar with concern.
"Henry?"
"Yeah?" I'm cutting you off. This is probably a good idea. I try to nod in my agreement with Mia, but it's too much effort. Instead, I slide slowly, almost gracefully, to the floor. I wake up much later at Mercy Hospital. Mia is sitting next to my bed. Her mascara has run all over her face. I'm hooked up to an IV and I feel bad. Very bad. In fact, every kind of bad. I turn my head and retch into a basin. Mia reaches over and wipes my mouth.
Henry,
Mia is whispering.
Hey, what the hell?
Henry, I'm so sorry.
Not your fault. What happened?
You passed out, and I did the math. How much do you weigh?
175.
Jesus, did you eat dinner?
I think about it.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, the stuff you were drinking was about 40 proof. And you had 2 whiskeys, but you seemed perfectly fine, and then all of a sudden you looked awful, and then you passed out. And I thought about it and realized you had a lot of booze in you. So I called 911, and here you are.
Thanks, I think.
Henry, do you have some kind of death wish?
I consider. Yes. I turn to the wall and pretend to sleep.
Saturday, April 8th, 1989. Claire is 17. Henry is 40. I'm sitting in Grandma Megram's room, doing the New York Times crossword puzzle with her. It's a bright, cool April morning, and I can see red tulips whipping in the wind in the garden. Mama is down there, planting something small and white over by the forsythia. Her hat is almost blowing off, and she keeps clapping her hand to her head, and finally takes the hat off and sets her work basket on it. I haven't seen Henry in almost 2 months. The next date on the list is 3 weeks away. We are approaching the time when I won't see him for more than 2 years. I used to be so casual about Henry when I was little. Seeing Henry wasn't anything too unusual. But now every time he's here is one less time he's going to be here. And things are different with us. I want something. I want Henry to say something, do something that proves this hasn't all been some kind of elaborate joke. I want. That's all. I am wanting. Grandma Megram is sitting in her blue wing chair by the window. I sit in the window seat with the newspaper in my lap. We are about halfway through the crossword. My attention has drifted. "Read that one again, child," says Grandma. 20 down, monkish monkey. 8 letters, second letter A, last letter N. Capuchin. She smiles, her unseeing eyes turn in my direction. To Grandma, I am a dark shadow against a somewhat lighter background. That's pretty good, eh? Yeah, that's great. Geez, try this one. 19 across, don't stick your elbow out so far. 10 letters, second letter U. Burma shave. Before your time. Ugh! I'll never get this. I stand up and stretch. I desperately need to go for a walk. My grandmother's room is comforting but claustrophobic. The ceiling is low. The wallpaper is dainty blue flowers. The bedspread is blue chintz. The carpet is white and it smells of powder and dentures and old skin. Grandma Megram sits trim and straight. Her hair is beautiful, white, but still slightly tinged with the red I have inherited from her, and perfectly coiled and pinned into a chignon. Grandma's eyes are like blue clouds. She has been blind for 9 years, and she has adapted well. As long as she is in the house, she can get around. She's been trying to teach me the art of crossword solving, but I have trouble caring enough to see one through by myself. Grandma used to do them in ink. Henry loves crossword puzzles. "It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" says Grandma, leaning back in her chair and rubbing her knuckles. I nod and then say, "Yes, but it's kind of windy. Mama's down there gardening and everything keeps blowing away on her.
How typical of Lucille, says her mother. Do you know, child, I'd like to go for a walk.
I was just thinking that same thing, I say.
She smiles and holds out her hands, and I gently pull her out of her chair. I fetch our coats and tie a scarf around Grandma's hair to stop it from getting messed up by the wind. Then we make our way slowly down the stairs and out the front door. We stand on the drive, and I turn to Grandma and say, Where do you want to go?
Let's go to the orchard, she says.
That's pretty far. Oh, Mama's waving. Wave back. We wave at Mama, who is all the way down by the fountain now. Peter, our gardener, is with her. He has stopped talking to her and is looking at us, waiting for us to go on so he and Mama can finish the argument they are having, probably about daffodils or peonies. Peter loves to argue with Mama, but she always gets her way in the end.
It's almost a mile to the orchard, Grandma.
Well, Claire, there's nothing wrong with my legs.
Okay, then, we'll go to the orchard.
I take her arm and away we go. When we get to the edge of the meadow, I say, Shade or sun? And she answers,
Oh, sun, to be sure.
And so we take the path that cuts through the middle of the meadow that leads to the clearing. As we walk, I describe. We're passing the bonfire pile, and there's a bunch of birds in it.
Oh, there they go.
Crows. Starlings. Doves, too, she says. Yes. We're at the gate now. Watch out, the path is a little muddy. I can see dog tracks, a pretty big dog. Maybe Joey from Allingham's. Everything is greening up pretty good. Here is that wild rose.
How high is the meadow? Asks Grandma.
Only about a foot. It's a real pale green. Here are the little oaks. She turns her face toward me, smiling.
Let's go and say hello.
I lead her to the oaks that grow just a few feet from the path. My grandfather planted these three oak trees in the 40s as a memorial to my great uncle Teddy, Grandma's brother who was killed in the Second World War. The oak trees still aren't very big, only about 15 feet tall. Grandma puts her hand on the trunk of the middle one and says, Hello. I don't know if she's addressing the tree or her brother. We walk on. As we walk over the rise, I see the meadow laid out before us, and Henry is standing in the clearing. I halt.
What is it? Grandma asks.
Nothing, I tell her. I lead her along the path.
What do you see? She asks me.
There is a hawk circling over the woods, I say.
What time is it?
I look at my watch. Almost noon. We enter the clearing. Henry stands very still. He smiles at me. He looks tired. His hair is graying. He is wearing his black overcoat. He stands out dark against the bright meadow.
Where is the rock? Grandma says. I want to sit down.
I guide her to the rock, help her to sit. She turns her face in Henry's direction and stiffens.
Who's there?
She asks me, urgency in her voice.
No one, I lie. There's a man there, she says, nodding toward Henry.
He looks at me with an expression that seems to mean, Go ahead, tell her. A dog is barking in the woods. I hesitate.
Claire, Grandma says.
She sounds scared. Introduce us, Henry says, quietly. Grandma is still, waiting. I put my arm around her shoulders. It's okay, Grandma, I say. This is my friend Henry. He's the one I told you about. Henry walks over to us and holds out his hand. I place Grandma's hand in his. Elizabeth Megram, I say to Henry.
So you're the one, Grandma says.
Yes, Henry replies. and this yes falls into my ears like balm. Yes. May I? She gestures with her hands toward Henry. Shall I sit next to you? Henry sits on the rock. I guide Grandma's hand to his face. He watches my face as she touches his. That tickles, Henry says to Grandma. Sandpaper, she says as she runs her fingertips across his unshaven chin. You're not a boy, she says. No. How old are you? I'm 8 years older than Claire. She looks puzzled. 25? I look at Henry's salt and pepper hair, at the creases around his eyes. He looks about 40, maybe older. 25, he says firmly. Somewhere out there. It's true. Claire tells me she's going to marry you, my grandmother says to Henry. He smiles at me. Yes, we are going to get married, in a few years when Claire is out of school. In my day, gentlemen came to dinner and met the family. Our situation is unorthodox. That hasn't been possible. I don't see why not. If you're going to cavort around in meadows with my granddaughter, you can certainly come up to the house and be inspected by her parents. I'd be delighted to, Henry says, standing up. But I'm afraid right now I have a train to catch. Just a moment, young man, Grandma begins as Henry says. Goodbye, Mrs. Megrim. It was great to finally meet you. Claire, I'm sorry, I can't stay longer. I reach out to Henry, but there's the noise, like all the sound is being sucked out of the world and he's already gone. I turn to Grandma. She's sitting on the rock with her hands stretched out, an expression of utter bewilderment on her face. What happened? She asks me, and I begin to explain. When I am finished, she sits with her head bowed, twisting her arthritic fingers into strange shapes. Finally, she raises her face toward me. But Claire, says my grandmother, he must be a demon. She says it matter-of-factly as though she's telling me that my coat's buttoned up wrong, or that it's time for lunch. What can I say? I've thought of that, I tell her. I take her hands to stop her from rubbing them red. But Henry is good. He doesn't feel like a demon. Grandma smiles. You talk as though you've met a peck of them. Don't you think a real demon would be sort of demonic? I think he would be nice as pie if he wanted to be. I choose my words carefully. Henry told me once that his doctor thinks he's a new kind of human. You know, sort of the next step in evolution. Grandma shakes her head. That is just as bad as being a demon. Goodness, Claire, why in the world would you want to marry such a person? Think of the children you would have. Popping into next week and back before breakfast. I laugh, but it will be exciting, like Mary Poppins or Peter Pan. She squeezes my hands just a little. Think for a minute, darling. In fairy tales, it's always the children who have the fine adventures. The mothers have to stay at home and wait for the children to fly in the window. I look at the pile of clothes lying crumpled on the ground where Henry has left them. I pick them up and fold them. Just a minute, I say, and I find the clothes box and put Henry's clothes in it. Let's go back to the house. It's past lunchtime. I help her off the rock. The wind is roaring in the grass, and we bend into it and make our way to the house. When we come to the rise, I turn and look back over the clearing. It's empty. A few nights later, I am sitting by Grandma's bed, reading Mrs. Dalloway to her. It's evening. I look up. Grandma seems to be asleep. I stop reading and close the book. Her eyes open. Hello, I say. Do you ever miss him? She asks me. Every day. Every minute. Every minute, she says. Yes. It's that way, isn't it? She turns on her side and burrows into the pillow. Good night, I say, turning out the lamp. As I stand in the dark looking down at Grandma in her bed, self-pity floods me as though I have been injected with it. It's that way, isn't it? Isn't it?
Eat or be eaten. Saturday, November 30th, 1991. Henry is 28, Claire is 20. Claire has invited me to dinner at her apartment. Charisse, Claire's roommate, and Gomez, Charisse's boyfriend, will also be dining. At 6:59 p.m. Central Standard Time, I stand in my Sunday best in Claire's vestibule with my finger on her buzzer, fragrant yellow freesia and an Australian Cabernet in my other arm, and my heart in my mouth. I have not been to Claire's before, nor have I met any of her friends. I have no idea what to expect. The buzzer makes a horrible sound, and I open the door. All the way up, hollers a deep male voice. I plod up four flights of stairs. The person attached to the voice is tall and blonde, sports the world's most immaculate pompadour and a cigarette, and is wearing a Solidarność t-shirt. He seems familiar, but I can't place him. For a person named Gomez, he looks very Polish. I find out later that his real name is Jan Gomolinski. Welcome, library boy, Gomez booms. Comrade, I reply, and hand him the flowers and the wine. We eyeball each other, achieve detente, and with a flourish, Gomez ushers me into the apartment. It's one of those wonderful endless railroad apartments from the 20s. A long hallway with the rooms attached almost as afterthoughts. There are two aesthetics at work here, funky and Victorian. This plays out in the spectacle of antique petite point chairs with heavy carved legs next to velvet Elvis paintings. I can hear Duke Ellington's I Got It Bad and That Ain't Good playing at the end of the hall, and Gomez leads me in that direction. Claire and Charisse are in the kitchen. My kittens! I've brought you a new toy, Gomez intones. It answers to the name of Henry, but you can call it Library Boy. I meet Claire's eyes. She shrugs her shoulders and holds her face out to be kissed. I oblige with a chaste peck and turn to shake hands with Charisse, who is short and round in a very pleasing way, all curves and long black hair. She has such a kind face that I have an urge to confide something. Anything to her, just to see her reaction. She's a small Filipino Madonna. In a sweet, don't fuck with me voice, she says, Oh, Gomez, do shut up. Hello, Henry. I'm Charisse Bonavent. Please ignore Gomez, I just keep him around to lift heavy objects. And sex. Don't forget the sex, Gomez reminds her. He looks at me. Beer? Sure. He delves into the fridge and hands me a Blatz. I pry off the cap and take a long pull. The kitchen looks as though a Pillsbury dough factory has exploded in it. Claire sees the direction of my gaze. I suddenly recollect that she doesn't know how to cook. It's a work in progress, says Claire. It's an installation piece, says Charisse. Are we going to eat it? Asks Gomez. I look from one to the other and we all burst out laughing. Do any of you know how to cook? No. Gomez can make rice. Only rice-a-roni. Claire knows how to order pizza. And Thai. I can order Thai, too. Charisse knows how to eat. Shut up, Gomez, say Charisse and Claire in unison. Well, what was that going to be? I inquire, nodding at the disaster on the counter. Claire hands me a magazine clipping. It's a recipe for chicken and shiitake risotto with winter squash and pine nut dressing. It's from Gourmand, and there are about 20 ingredients. Do you have all this stuff? Claire nods. The shopping part I can do. It's the assembly that perplexes. I examine the chaos more closely. I can make something out of this. You can cook? I nod.
It cooks! Dinner is saved! Have another beer!
Gomez exclaims. Charisse looks relieved and smiles warmly at me. Claire, who has been hanging back almost fearfully, sidles over to me and whispers, "You're not mad?" I kiss her, just a tad longer than is really polite in front of other people. I straighten up, take off my jacket, and roll up my sleeves. "Give me an apron," I demand. "You, Gomez, open that wine. Claire, clean up all that spilled stuff. It's turning to cement. Charisse, would you set the table?" 1 hour and 43 minutes later, we are sitting around the dining room table eating chicken risotto stew with pureed squash. Everything has lots of butter in it. We are all drunk as skunks.
The whole time Henry is making dinner, Gomez is standing around the kitchen, making jokes and smoking and drinking beer. And whenever no one is looking, he makes awful faces at me. Finally, Charisse catches him and draws her finger across her throat, and he stops. We are talking about the most banal stuff. Our jobs and school and where we grew up. And all the usual things that people talk about when they meet each other for the first time. Gomez tells Henry about his job being a lawyer, representing abused and neglected children who are wards of the state. Charisse regales us with tales of her exploits at Lesus Nature, a tiny software company that is trying to make computers understand when people talk to them, and her art, which is making pictures that you look at on a computer. Henry tells stories about the Newberry Library and the odd people who come to study the books.
"Does the Newberry really have a book made out of human skin?" Charisse asks Henry.
"Yep. The Chronicles of Nawat Wazir Hyderabad. It was found in the palace of the King of Delhi in 1857. Come by sometime, and I'll pull it out for you." Charisse shudders and grins. Henry is stirring the stew. When he says, "Chow time," we all flock to the table. All this time, Gomez and Henry have been drinking beer, and Charisse and I have been sipping wine, and Gomez has been topping up our glasses, and we have not been eating much. But I do not realize how drunk we all are until I almost miss sitting down on the chair Henry holds for me, and Gomez almost sets his own hair on fire while lighting the candles. Gomez holds up his glass. "The revolution!" Charisse and I raise our glasses, and Henry does too. "The revolution!" We begin eating with enthusiasm. The risotto is slippery and mild. The squash is sweet. The chicken is swimming in butter. It makes me want to cry, it's so good. Henry takes a bite, then points his fork at Gomez. "Which revolution?"
"Pardon?"
"Which revolution are we toasting?" Charisse and I look at each other in alarm, but it is too late. Gomez smiles, and my heart sinks.
"The next one.
The one where the proletariat rises up and the rich get eaten and capitalism is vanquished in favor of a classless society?"
"That very one."
Henry winks at me.
"That seems rather hard on Claire. And what are you planning to do with the intelligentsia?"
"Oh," Gomez says, "we will probably eat them too. But we'll keep you around as a cook. This is outstanding grub." Charisse touches Henry's arm, confidentially. "We aren't really going to eat anybody," she says. "We are just going to redistribute their assets."
"That's a relief," Henry replies. "I wasn't looking forward to cooking Claire."
Gomez says, "It's a shame, though. I'm sure Claire would be very tasty." "I wonder what cannibal cuisine is like," I say. "Is there a cannibal cookbook?"
"The raw and the cooked," says Charisse.
Henry objects.
"That's not really a how-to. I don't think Levi Strauss gives any recipes."
"We could just adapt a recipe," says Gomez, taking another helping of the chicken. "You know, Claire with porcini mushrooms and marinara sauce over linguine. Or breast of Claire a l'orange. Or..."
"Hey," I say, "what if I don't want to be eaten?"
"Sorry, Claire," Gomez says gravely. "I'm afraid you have to be eaten for the greater good." Henry catches my eye and smiles.
Don't worry, Claire. Come the revolution, I'll hide you at the Newbery. You can live in the stacks, and I'll feed you Snickers and Doritos from the staff lunchroom. They'll never find you. I shake my head. What about first we kill all the lawyers? No, Gomez says. You can't do anything without lawyers. The revolution would get all balled up in 10 minutes if lawyers weren't there to keep it in line. But my dad's a lawyer, I tell him, so you can't eat us after all. He's the wrong kind of lawyer, Gomez says. He does estates for rich people. I, on the other hand, represent the poor, oppressed children. Oh, shut up, Gomez, says Charisse. You're hurting Claire's feelings. I'm not. Claire wants to be eaten for the revolution, don't you, Claire? No. Oh. What about the categorical imperative? Asks Henry. Say what? You know, the golden rule. Don't eat other people unless you are willing to be eaten. Gomez is cleaning his nails with the tines of his fork. Don't you think it's really eat or be eaten that makes the world go round? Yeah, mostly. But aren't you yourself a case in point for altruism? Henry asks. Sure, but I am widely considered to be a dangerous nutcase. Gomez says this with feigned indifference, but I can see that he is puzzled by Henry. Claire, he says, what about dessert? Oh my God, I almost forgot, I say, standing up too fast and grabbing the table for support. I'll get it. I'll help you, says Gomez, following me into the kitchen. I'm wearing heels, and as I walk into the kitchen, I catch the door sill and stagger forward, and Gomez grabs me. For a moment, we stand pressed together, and I feel his hands on my waist. But he lets me go. You're drunk, Claire, Gomez tells me. I know, so are you. I press the button on the coffee maker, and coffee begins to drip into the pot. I lean against the counter and carefully take the cellophane off the plate of brownies. Gomez is standing close behind me, and he says very quietly, leaning so that his breath tickles my ear, "He's the same guy." "What do you mean?" "That guy I warned you about. Henry, he's the guy." Charisse walks into the kitchen, and Gomez jumps away from me and opens the fridge. "Hey," she says. "Can I help?" "Here, take the coffee cups." We all juggle cups and saucers and plates and brownies and make it safely back to the table. Henry is waiting as though he's at the dentist, with a look of patient dread. I laugh. It's so exactly the look he used to have when I brought him food in the meadow. But he doesn't remember. He hasn't been there yet. "Relax," I say. "It's only brownies. Even I can do brownies." Everyone laughs and sits down. The brownies turn out to be kind of undercooked. "Brownies tartare," says Charisse. "Salmonella fudge," says Gomez. Henry says, "I've always liked dough," and licks his fingers. Gomez rolls a cigarette, lights it, and takes a deep drag.
Gomez lights a cigarette and leans back in his chair. There's something about this guy that bugs me. Maybe it's the casual possessiveness toward Claire, or the garden variety Marxism. I'm sure I've seen him before. Past or future? Let's find out. "You look very familiar," I say to him. "Hmm? Yeah, I think we've seen each other around." "I've got it. Iggy Pop of the Riviera Theater?" He looks startled. "Yeah. You were with that blonde girl, Ingrid Carmichael, I always used to see you with." Gomez and I both look at Claire. She's staring intently at Gomez, and he smiles at her. She looks away, but not at me. Charisse comes to the rescue. "You saw Iggy without me?" Gomez says, "You're out of town." Charisse pouts. "I miss everything," she says to me. "I missed Patti Smith, and now she's retired. I miss Talking Heads the last time they toured." "Patti Smith will tour again," I say. "She will? How do you know?" asks Charisse. Claire and I exchange glances. "I'm just guessing," I tell her. We begin exploring each other's musical tastes and discover that we're all devoted to punk. Gomez tells us about seeing the New York Dolls in Florida just before Johnny Thunders left the band. I describe a Lena Lovitch concert I managed to catch on one of my time travels. Charisse and Claire are excited because the Violent Femmes are playing the Aragon Ballroom in a few weeks, and Charisse has scored free tickets. The evening winds down without further ado. Claire walks me downstairs. We stand in the foyer between the outer door and the inner door. "I'm sorry," she says. "Oh, not at all. It was fun. I didn't mind cooking." "No," Claire says, looking at her shoes. "About Gomez." It's cold in the foyer. I wrap my arms around Claire and she leans against me. "What about Gomez?" I ask her. Something's on her mind. But then she shrugs. "It'll be okay," she says, and I take her word for it. We kiss. I open the outer door and Claire opens the inner door. I walk down the sidewalk and look back. Claire is still standing there in the half-open doorway watching me. I stand, wanting to go back and hold her, wanting to go back upstairs with her. She turns and begins to walk upstairs, and I watch until she's out of sight. Saturday, December 14th, 1991, and Tuesday, May 9th, 2000. Henry is 36. I'm stomping the living shit out of a large, drunk suburban guy who had the effrontery to call me a faggot and then tried to beat me up to prove his point. We're in the alley next to the Vic Theater. I can hear the smoking Pope's bass leaking out of the theater's side exits as I systematically smash this idiot's nose and go to work on his ribs. I'm having a rotten evening, and this fool is taking the brunt of my frustration. "Hey, library boy." I turn from my groaning homophobic yuppie to find Gomez leaning against a dumpster, looking grim. "Comrade." I step back from the guy I've been bashing, who slides gratefully to the pavement, doubled up. "How goes it?" I'm very relieved to see Gomez. Delighted, actually. But he doesn't seem to share my pleasure. Gee, I don't want to disturb you or anything, but that's a friend of mine you're dismembering there." "Oh, surely not." "Well, he requested it. Just walked right up to me and said, 'Sir, I urgently need to be firmly macerated.'" "Oh, well, hey, well done. Fucking artistic, actually. Thank you. Do you mind if I just scoop up old Nick here and take him to the hospital? Be my guest." Damn, I was planning to appropriate Nick's clothing, especially his shoes. Brand new Doc Martens, deep red, barely worn. "Gomez."
"Yeah?"
He stoops to lift his friend, who spits a tooth into his own lap. "What's the date?" "December 14th. "What year?" He looks up at me like a man who has better things to do than humor lunatics and lifts Nick in a fireman's carry that must be excruciating. Nick begins to whimper. 1991. You must be drunker than you look." He walks up the alley and disappears in the direction of the theater entrance. I calculate rapidly. Today isn't that long after Claire and I started dating. Therefore, Gomez and I hardly know each other. No wonder he was giving me the hairy eyeball. He reappears unencumbered.
"I made Trent deal with it. Nick's his brother."
He wasn't best pleased. We start walking east down the alley. "Forgive me for asking, dear library boy, but why on earth are you dressed like that?" I'm wearing blue jeans, a baby blue sweater with little yellow ducks all over it, and a neon red down vest with pink tennis shoes. Really, it's not surprising that someone would feel they needed to hit me. It was the best I could do at the time. I hope the guy I took these off of was close to home. It's about 20 degrees out here. "Why are you consorting with frat boys?"
"Oh, we went to law school together."
We were walking by the back door of the Army-Navy surplus store, and I experience a deep desire to be wearing normal clothing. I decide to risk appalling Gomez. I know he'll get over it. I stop. "Comrade, this'll only take a moment. I just need to take care of something. Could you wait at the end of the alley?"
"What are you doing?"
"Nothing, breaking and entering. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain."
"Mind if I come along?"
"Yes." He looks crestfallen. "All right, if you must." I step into the niche which shelters the back door. This is the third time I've broken into this place, although the other two occasions are both in the future at the moment. I've got it down to a science. First, I open the insignificant combination lock that secures the security gate, slide the grate back, pick the Yale lock with the inside of an old pen and a safety pin found earlier on Belmont Avenue, and use a piece of aluminum between the double doors to lift the inside bolt. Voila! Altogether, it takes about 3 minutes. Gomez regards me with almost religious awe.
Where did you learn to do that?
It's a knack, I reply modestly. We step inside. There's a panel of blinking red lights trying to look like a burglar alarm system, but I know better. It's very dark in here. I mentally review the layout and the merchandise. Don't touch anything, Gomez. I want to be warm and inconspicuous. I step carefully through the aisles, and my eyes adjust to the dark. I start with pants. Black Levi's. I select a dark blue flannel shirt, a heavy black wool overcoat with an industrial-strength lining, wool socks, boxers, heavy mountain-climbing gloves, and a hat with ear flaps. In the shoe department, I find, to my great satisfaction, Docs, exactly like the ones my buddy Nick was wearing. I'm ready for action. Gomez, meanwhile, is poking around behind the counter. Don't bother, I tell him. This place doesn't leave cash in the register at night. Let's go. We leave the way we came. I close the door gently and pull the grate across. I have my previous set of clothing in a shopping bag. Later, I'll try to find a Salvation Army collection bin. Gomez looks at me expectantly, like a large dog who's waiting to see if I have any more lunch meat. Which reminds me. I'm ravenous. Let's go to Ann Sather's. Ann Sather's? I was expecting you to propose bank robbery or manslaughter at the very least. You're on a roll, man. Don't stop now. I must pause in my labors to refuel. Come on. We cross from the alley to Ann Sather's Swedish restaurant's parking lot. The attendant mutely regards us as we traverse his kingdom. We cut over to Belmont. It's only 9 o'clock and the street is teeming with its usual mix of runaways, homeless mental cases, clubbers, and suburban thrill-seekers. Ann Sather's stands out as an island of normalcy amid the tattoo parlors and condom boutiques. We enter and wait by the bakery to be seated. My stomach gurgles. The Swedish decor is comforting. All wood paneling and swirling red marbling. We're seated in the smoking section right in front of the fireplace. Things are looking up. We remove our coats, settle in, read the menus, even though as lifelong Chicagoans we could probably sing them from memory in two-part harmony. Gomez lays all his smoking paraphernalia next to his silverware. Do you mind? Yes, but go ahead. The price of Gomez's company is marinating in the constant stream of cigarette smoke that flows from his nostrils. His fingers are a deep ochre color. They flutter delicately over the thin papers as he rolls drum tobacco into a thick cylinder, licks the paper, twists it, sticks it between his lips, and lights it. Ah. For Gomez, a half hour without smoke is an anomaly. I always enjoy watching people satisfy their appetites, even if I don't happen to share them. You don't smoke? Anything? I run. Oh. Yeah, shit, you're in great shape. I thought you had about killed Nick, and you weren't even winded. He was too drunk to fight. Just a big sodden punching bag. Why'd you lay into him like that? It was just stupidity. The waiter arrives, tells us his name is Lance, and the specials are salmon and creamed peas. He takes our drink orders and speeds away. I toy with the cream dispenser. He saw how I was dressed, concluded that I was easy meat, got obnoxious, wanted to beat me up, wouldn't take no for an answer, and got a surprise. I was minding my own business, really, I was. Gomez looks thoughtful. Which is what, exactly? Pardon? Henry, I may look like a chump, but in fact your old Uncle Gomez is not completely sans clues. I've been paying attention to you for some time, before our little Claire brought you home, as a matter of fact. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of it, but you are moderately notorious in certain circles. I know a lot of people who know you. People, well, women. Women who know you. He squints at me through the haze of his smoke. They say some pretty strange things. Lance arrives with my coffee and Gomez's milk. We order. A cheeseburger and fries for Gomez, split pea soup, the salmon, sweet potatoes, and mixed fruit for me. I feel like I'm gonna keel over right this minute if I don't get a lot of calories fast. Lance departs swiftly. I'm having trouble caring very much about the misdeeds of my earlier self, much less justifying them to Gomez. None of his business, anyway. But he's waiting for my answer. I stir cream into my coffee, watching the slight white scum on the top dissipate in swirls. I throw caution to the winds. It doesn't matter, after all. What would you like to know, comrade? Everything. I want to know why a seemingly mild-mannered librarian beats a guy into a coma over nothing while wearing kindergarten teacher clothing. I want to know why Ingrid Carmichael tried to kill herself 8 days ago. I want to know why you look 10 years older right now than you did the last time I saw you. Your hair's going gray. I want to know why you can pick a Yale lock. I want to know why Claire had a photograph of you before she actually met you. Claire had a photo of me before 1991? I didn't know that. Oops. What did the photo look like? Gomez regards me. More like you at the moment, not like you looked a couple weeks ago when you came over for dinner. That was 2 weeks ago? Lord, this is only the second time Gomez and I have met. It was taken outdoors. You're smiling. The date on the back is June 1988. The food arrives and we pause to arrange it on our little table. I start eating as though there's no tomorrow. Gomez sits, watching me eat, his food untouched. I've seen Gomez do his thing in court with hostile witnesses, just like this. He simply wills them to spill the beans. I don't mind telling all, I just want to eat first. In fact, I need Gomez to know the truth, because he's going to save my ass repeatedly in the years to come. I'm halfway through the salmon, and he's still sitting. Eat, eat, I say in my best imitation of Mrs. Kim. He dips a fry in ketchup and munches it. Don't worry, I'll confess. Just let me have my last meal in peace. He capitulates and starts to eat his burger. Neither of us says a word until I've finished consuming my fruit. Lance brings me more coffee. I doctor it, stir it. Gomez is looking at me as though he wants to shake me. I resolve to amuse myself at his expense. Okay, here it is. Time travel. Gomez rolls his eyes and grimaces, but says nothing. I am a time traveler. At the moment, I'm 36 years old. This afternoon was May 9th, 2000. It was a Tuesday. I was at work. I had just finished a show and tell for a bunch of Caxton Club members, and I had gone back to the stacks to reshelve the books, when I suddenly found myself on School Street in 1991. I had the usual problem of getting something to wear. I hid under somebody's porch for a while. I was cold and nobody was coming along, and finally, this young guy dressed... Well, you saw how I was dressed. I mugged him, took his cash and everything he was wearing except his underwear. Scared him silly. I think he thought I was going to rape him or something. Anyway, I had clothes. Okay, but in this neighborhood, you can't dress like that without having certain misunderstandings arise. So I've been taking shit all evening from various people, and your friend just happened to be the last straw. I'm sorry if he's very damaged. I very much wanted his clothes, especially his shoes. Gomez glanced under the table at my feet. I find myself in situations like that all the time. No pun intended. There's something wrong with me. I get dislocated in time, for no reason. I can't control it. I never know when it's going to happen or where and when I'll end up. So in order to cope, I pick locks, shoplift, pick pockets, mug people, panhandle, break and enter, steal cars, lie, fold, spindle and mutilate. You name it, I've done it. Murder. Well, not that I know of. I've never raped anybody either. I look at him as I speak. He's poker-faced. Ingrid. Do you actually know Ingrid? I know Celia Atley. Dear me, you do keep strange company. How did Ingrid try to kill herself? An overdose of Valium. 1991? Yeah, okay, that would be Ingrid's fourth suicide attempt. What? Ah, you didn't know that. Celia's only selectively informative. Ingrid actually succeeded in doing herself in on January 2nd, 1994. She shot herself in the chest. Henry, you know it happened 6 years ago, and I'm still angry at her. What a waste. but she was severely depressed for a long time, and she just sunk down into it. I couldn't do anything for her. It was one of the things we used to fight about. This is a pretty sick joke, library boy. You want proof? He just smiles. How about that photo? The one you said Claire has? The smile vanishes. Okay, I admit that I am a wee bit befuddled by that. I met Claire for the first time in October 1991. She met me for the first time in September 1977. She was 6. I will be 38. She has known me all her life. In 1991, I'm just getting to know her. By the way, you should ask Claire all this stuff. She'll tell you. I already did. She told me. Well, hell, Gomez, you're taking up valuable time here, making me tell you all over again. You didn't believe her? No, would you? Sure. Claire is very truthful. It's that Catholic upbringing that does it. Lance comes by with more coffee. I'm already highly caffeinated, but more can't hurt. So, what kind of proof are you looking for? Claire said you disappear. Yeah, it's one of my more dramatic parlor tricks. Stick to me like glue, and sooner or later, I vanish. It may take minutes, hours, or days, but I'm very reliable that way. Do we know each other in 2000? Yeah. I grin at him. We're good friends. Tell me my future. Oh no, bad idea. Nope. Why not? Gomez, things happen. Knowing about them in advance makes everything weird. You can't change anything anyway. Why? Causation only runs forward. Things happen once, only once. If you know things, I feel trapped most of the time. If you're in time, not knowing, you're free. Trust me. He looks frustrated. You'll be the best man at our wedding. I'll be yours. You have a great life, Gomez, but I'm not going to tell you the particulars. Stock tips? Yeah, why not? In 2000, the stock market is insane, but there are amazing fortunes to be had, and Gomez will be one of the lucky ones. Ever heard of the internet? No. It's a computer thing. A vast worldwide network with regular people all plugged in, communicating by phone lines with computers. You want to buy technology stocks. Netscape, America Online, Sun Microsystems, Yahoo, Microsoft, Amazon.com. He's taking notes. .com? Don't worry about it. Just buy it at the IPO. I smile. Clap your hands if you believe in fairies. I thought you were poleaxing anyone who insinuated anything about fairies this evening. It's from Peter Pan, you illiterate. I suddenly feel nauseous. I don't want to cause a scene here now. I jump up. Follow me, I say, running for the men's room, Gomez close behind me. I burst into the miraculously empty John. Sweat is streaming down my face. I throw up into the sink. Jesus H. Christ, says Gomez. Damn it, library. But I lose the rest of whatever he's about to say, because I'm lying on my side, naked, on a cold linoleum floor in pitch blackness. I'm dizzy, so I lie there for a while. I reach out my hand and touch the spines of books. I'm in the stacks at the Newbery. I get up and stagger to the end of the aisle and flip the switch. Light floods the row I'm standing in, blinding me. My clothes and the cart of books I was shelving are in the next aisle over. I get dressed, shelve the books, and gingerly open the security door to the stacks. I don't know what time it is, the alarms could be on. But no, everything is as it was. Isabel is instructing a new patron in the ways of the reading room. Matt walks by and waves. The sun pours in the windows and the hands of the reading room clock point to 4:15. I've been gone less than 15 minutes. Amelia sees me and points to the door. I'm going out to Starbucks. You want Java? No, I don't think so, but thanks. I've a horrible headache. I stick my face into Roberto's office and tell him I don't feel well. He nods sympathetically, gestures at the phone, which is spewing light-speed Italian into his ear. I grab my stuff and leave. Just another routine day at the office for Library Boy.
Sunday, December 15th, 1991. Claire is 20. It's a beautiful, sunny Sunday morning, and I'm on my way home